Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we are going to try to do something that feels a little bit impossible. We're going to try to physically locate your past.
And just to be clear, we don't mean digging up old yearbooks.
You know.
Or scrolling through your cloud storage.
Right, I mean literally in the physical universe. Where is it? If I asked you right now to think of your first day of high school or, you know, the smell of your grandmother's kitchen, where was that information 5 seconds ago? Before I asked.
Most people have a very specific, very confident answer for this.
Oh, absolutely. It's the filing cabinet model. Or, you know, for us, the hard drive model. We have this idea that the brain is a container.
Mm-hmm.
It writes data to a neuron, stores it in a folder called childhood, and when we need it, the search bar pulls it up.
It is a comforting model. It's logical. It's mechanical. And according to the philosopher Henri Bergson, it is completely fundamentally wrong.
And that is the cliff we are jumping off today. We are diving into Bergson's 1896 classic, Matter and Memory. And I have to say, when I first saw the publication date, 1896, I thought, okay, surely this is outdated.
Right. You think, what could he possibly know?
We have MRIs now. We have mapped the cortex. Why are we listening to a guy like writing by candlelight?
It is a fair question.
Yeah.
But the fascinating thing is that modern neuroscience is actually circling back to the very problem Bergson identified.
Yeah.
He wasn't trying to map neurons. He was trying to solve the hard problem before we even called it that.
Which is, how does a physical lump of gray matter meat essentially produce the intangible experience of a memory?
Exactly.
And his answer is so radical, he argues that the brain does not store memories at all.
Correct. He argues that if you look for a memory inside a brain cell, you are looking for the wrong thing in the wrong place.
Okay, so if my brain isn't a library, what is it? And if my memories aren't in my head, where are they? That's what we're unpacking.
We have to talk about his world of images and the two types of memory.
And then we're going to try to visualize Bergson's famous cone of memory.
Which is probably one of the most mind-bending diagrams in the history of philosophy.
It really is. But before we get to the geometry, we have to start with reality itself. Bergson kicks off the book by redefining what the universe is, and he uses this term, images. But he doesn't mean a JPEG, does he?
No, and this is the first hurdle everyone trips over. We have to be precise. In philosophy, you've got this this eternal war between two camps. You have the realists and the idealists.
Let's break those down really quick. Realism is the table is there whether I look at it or not.
Exactly. Matter is a solid, independent thing. Totally separate from your mind. Then you have idealism, which says, no, everything you see is just a construction in your brain. The table is just an idea.
So either the world is dead matter out there, or it's a hallucination in here.
And Bergson looks at both and says, you're both missing the point. He proposes this middle ground. He calls all of matter images. An image for him is existence itself. It's something more than just a picture in your head, but less than some hidden, unknowable thing.
Okay, so the universe is this, like a soup of these images. My desk, the microphone, the stars, they're all acting on each other.
Right, the vibrating, interconnected web. But in the middle of all of this, there is one privileged image, one image that stands out.
My body.
Your body, and specifically, the brain. Bergson calls the body a center of action. And this is the key to everything. The body isn't designed to think. It isn't designed to store. It is designed to act.
This was the first big aha moment for me in the reading. We think of our senses, our eyes, our ears, as these neutral cameras, you know, like we're just recording a documentary of reality.
And Bergson says, absolutely not. If you perceived reality as it truly is, every atom, every vibration, it would be blinding. It'd be chaos. You couldn't function.
So perception isn't about letting information in. It's about keeping information out.
Precisely. He calls conscious perception a necessary poverty. Your body is like a filter. It looks at the massive, infinite data of the universe and says, nope, don't care about that, don't care. Oh, that moving shape might be a tiger. I care about that.
It filters for utility. What can I use?
Right. Perception is a subtraction from reality, not an addition to it.
Okay, so if my perception is just a slice of reality filtered by my body's needs, where does the brain fit in? If it's not generating the image and it's not storing it, what is it doing?
Bergson uses an analogy that was very high-tech for 1896. He calls the brain a central telephonic exchange.
A switchboard.
Think about it. A call comes in, that's sensory input. I see a red light. The operator plugs that into an output. That's the motor movement. Foot hits the brake.
So the brain is just a connector.
That's its primary job. It analyzes an incoming signal and selects the right physical reaction. It's a machine for turning sensation into movement. Bergson is so strict about this, the brain adds nothing to the image. It certainly doesn't archive it, it just routes the call.
But this is where the hard problem comes crashing back in. If the brain is just a router, where is the past? Because I'm not just a robot reacting to red lights, I have a history. I remember my first kiss, I remember the plot of Star Wars. If those aren't stored in the switchboard, where are they?
This is the core of his whole argument, and it brings us to a really critical distinction. Mm-hmm. It's something that article on SageMind about recognition versus recollection really nailed.
Right.
We use the word memory as this catch-all term, but Bergson separates it into two radically different things.
This is the distinction between habit memory and pure memory.
Correct. And confusing these two is what leads to all the errors, he thinks. Let's start with habit memory. This is the memory of the body.
The source material uses the example of learning a poem by heart. I think that's a great way to visualize it.
It's perfect. So imagine you have a stanza of poetry you need to memorize. You sit down, you read it once, you stumble, you read it again. And again, let's say you read it 50 times.
And now I can say it without looking. I've memorized it.
But have you? Bergson asks. Is this really memory? Or is it a machine you've built?
Well, it feels like memory. I can recite it.
But look at how you recite it. You aren't really thinking about the past. You're triggering a motor sequence. Your lips, your tongue, your neural pathways, they have learned a choreography. It's no different than your legs knowing how to walk.
It's muscle memory.
Exactly. It lives in the present. When you recite that poem, you are acting. You are unfolding a habit you built up. It's a closed system of movement. It's practical, but it doesn't require a connection to the past.
Okay, I buy that. It's acted, not represented. But surely I have memories that aren't just, you know, muscle spasms.
And that is the second type. Pure memory. Go back to that example. You read the poem 50 times, but I want you to remember the third time you read it.
The third time. Specifically.
Yes. Remember the chair you were in. Remember the way the light was hitting the page. Maybe you heard a car drive by outside. That specific moment.
Okay, that's different. That's a unique event. I can't practice that moment. It happened once and it's gone.
Precisely. That is pure memory. It records every single moment. It dates every event. It is unique, unrepeatable, and deeply personal. It doesn't live in the muscles. It lives in the past.
And Bergson thinks we confuse these two all the time.
Constantly. We think that because we can repeat a fact, a habit, we are accessing the past. But the habit is just the body acting in the now. Pure memory is the spirit dwelling in the then.
The spirit dwelling in the then? That sounds almost ghostly.
It is ghostly. Bergson explicitly says that pure memory is virtual. It has no physical power. It's a ghost waiting to be summoned.
Okay, so we have the body acting in the present with its habits, and the spirit holding the past as pure memory. But they have to connect, right? I mean, I use my past to guide my actions.
And to explain how the ghost touches the machine, we have to look at his most famous diagram, the inverted cone.
Listeners, you're going to have to use your mental canvas here. This is tough without visuals, but let's try to paint it. Imagine a cone, like an ice cream cone.
But turn it upside down.
Right.
So the wide, round base is up in the air.
Right, and the sharp point is pointing down, touching the ground.
Okay. Now, that wide base at the top, that represents the totality of your past. That is pure memory. It contains everything that has ever happened to you, suspended in time. It is motionless. It's all there.
Everything. Even the stuff I can't remember.
Everything. Bergson argues nothing is ever lost. It's all just hanging up there in that base. Now, look at the bottom. The sharp point of the cone. Bergson calls this point S, and it's touching a flat plane.
And the plane is... what?
The plane is my actual representation of the universe.
Uh-huh.
Or, in simple terms, the present moment.
So the point of the cone is where this huge weight of the past touches the flat reality of the present.
Exactly. And what is at that point? What is the object that exists right at the cutting edge of the present?
My body.
The body. And specifically the brain. The brain is the tip of the cone. Its job is to be the contact point with reality. It just advances forward through time.
This is a wild image. So my consciousness is this massive funnel of past experiences, but only the very tip of it, my current bodily state, is actually touching the real world.
Yes. And this explains the mechanism of remembering. When you are just living your life, acting out of habit, you are staying right at point S, just reacting. But let's say you need to recall a name.
I hate when that happens right on the tip of my tongue.
That sensation. That is you leaving the point and going up into the cone.
Yeah.
You are jumping into the virtual. You're swimming around in that base looking for the right image.
So I find the image in the cloud. How do I get it out?
You have to push it down. The memory has to descend the cone. It has to squeeze itself down, getting tighter and more focused, trying to fit into that tiny point at the bottom so it can manifest.
It's like squeezing toothpaste through a really small nozzle.
That's actually a pretty good analogy. But here is the critical insight.
Yeah.
The brain does not contain the cone. The brain is just the nozzle. Its true function isn't storage, it's filtration. It lets the useful memories through to guide action, and it blocks the useless ones.
It blocks them.
Think about it. If that valve were wide open, if the entire base of the cone crashed down onto the point at once, what would happen?
I'd be remembering my third birthday and what I had for lunch yesterday and the time I stubbed my toe all at the exact same time.
You would be completely overwhelmed. You'd be hallucinating your entire life simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't cross the street because you'd be too busy reliving 1999. The brain's job is to keep you focused on now, on survival. It inhibits the past.
This really flips the script. We usually think, oh, I have a bad memory. My brain is failing to retrieve. Bergson would say, no, your brain is doing its job too well. It's blocking the past so you can focus on driving the car.
Exactly. And we have to tune the body to let the right memories slip through.
I want to zoom in on this because this is where that Sage Mind article on recognition versus recollection really expanded things for me. We do this 1,000 times a day. I see a face, I recognize it. How does the cone model explain that?
This is one of the most practical applications of the theory. He talks about automatic recognition and attentive recognition.
Automatic is the body, I'm guessing?
Yep. You walk down your street. You don't need to consciously conjure up a memory of it. Your legs just know the slope. Your body recognizes the environment by acting appropriately in it. You're just surfing on the point of the cone.
That's that autopilot feeling, driving home and not remembering the drive.
That's habit recognition. But then there's attentive recognition. Suppose you see a blurry shape in the distance. Your body doesn't know what to do yet, so you stop.
I squint. I focus. I'm trying to figure out what I'm looking at.
Now the mind gets involved. The perception gives you the outline. But to really know what it is, your mind sends memory images down from the cone. They shoot down to overlay the object.
The source material uses a telegraph clerk analogy. Can we unpack that?
It's great. Bergson says attention is like a telegraph clerk who gets a message but thinks it might be garbled. So he sends it back word for word to check it against the original. We project our memory onto the object to verify it.
So I look at the blurry shape and I launch a hypothesis. Is that a dog? I grab my dog memory from the cone and try to fit it over the shape.
And if it fits, click. You recognize it. Ah, it's a dog.
And if it doesn't fit?
You reject it. You go higher up the cone. Grab a different memory, maybe plastic bag, and you try to overlay that. It's this dynamic circuit. Perception goes up, memory comes down. They meet in the middle.
This feels so much more active than the search bar model. It's a dance. But what happens when the dance stops? Bergson spends a lot of time on aphasia word deafness.
This is his smoking gun, evidence against the brain of storage theory. The materialist view is simple. A patient has a stroke here, they forget the word for chair. Therefore, the word chair was stored in that piece of meat.
It's the smashed hard drive argument. If I smash the drive, the data is gone.
But Bergson looked closer. He noted that often these patients didn't lose the memory completely. It might pop up in a dream. Or they could sing the word in a song, even if they couldn't speak it.
Wait, that destroys the hard drive theory. If the file was deleted, it shouldn't exist in a song. It should be gone, gone.
Exactly. So Bergson argues, the memory is still there, the cone is intact, the spirit is fine.
Then why can't they speak?
Because the motor diagram is broken.
Oh.
Remember, the brain is the summit. It's the landing strip. The memory is in the cone, trying to descend. But the mechanism in the brain that lets that memory insert itself into reality, the tongue movement, the neural trigger, is damaged.
It's like a ghost trying to possess a machine with a broken steering wheel. The driver is there, but the car won't turn.
Precisely. The lesion in the brain affects the access to the memory, or the realization of the memory, but not the memory itself. The past is indestructible. The brain damage just breaks the connection to the present.
I have to say, there's something incredibly hopeful about that. It implies that our inner lives, our history, our identity are much more resilient than our biology.
It suggests that consciousness is vast, much vaster than what we can squeeze through the tiny aperture of our bodies at any given moment.
So we've been swimming in some pretty deep philosophical waters here. If I'm just a normal person trying to learn something new, what do I do with this?
I think the biggest takeaway is to change how you view learning. Stop thinking of it as stuffing facts into a box.
Right. No more cramming.
Learning is about balance. You need to build the habit memory, the practice, the repetition, the muscle memory, because that frees up the mind. If your body knows how to conjugate verbs automatically, your cone is free to explore and be creative.
If you're stuck manually operating your body for every little thing, you have no bandwidth left for the spirit.
Exactly. Automate the basics so the spirit can fly.
Yeah.
And secondly, recognize that attention is active. You have to send memories out to meet the world. Passive observation isn't enough.
It really changes the view of the human being. We aren't just biological machines. We are this intersection of time and matter.
We are the bridge.
I want to leave our listeners with one last thought to mull over, a little provocative nugget for the road.
Go for it.
We've talked about how the brain filters the past to keep us in the present. We've established that Bergson believes memories are not in the brain.
Right.
And we've said that the past preserves itself automatically. Mm. So if the cone exists independently of the summit, does that mean your past is indestructible, even if the brain dies?
That is the ultimate implication of his theory. If the brain is just the antenna and the antenna breaks, mm-hmm. the signal doesn't necessarily vanish. The cone, the totality of who you were, has no reason to disappear. It just loses its way to manifest in the material world.
It becomes purely virtual.
It suggests that the spirit is not something that emerges from the body, but something that intersects with it. And when that intersection ends, the spirit remains.
That is a heavy thought for a commute, but that's why we do this.
Indeed.
Thank you for taking the plunge with us on the deep dive. Check your memory cones, keep your filters clean, and we'll see you next time.